Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, operators, investors, and academics who get me smarter on how to build better climate tech companies. This time, I spoke to Jit Bhattacharya, the founder and CEO of the Kenyan electric bus company Bazi Go. He's one of those people with whom I do not know where to start asking questions. Jit has spent significant time in Silicon Valley working on battery systems, then moving on to Apple, then building one of the biggest solar businesses in Africa, moving on to being an investor, and now driving his next venture forward, Bazi Go. Jit says about himself that he is an intense person, and so is this podcast. It's a mix of lessons on entrepreneurship, African hardware business building, and career advice. So there's something for everyone here. Enjoy.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hey Jit, thank you so much for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Yeah. It's a little bit of a crazy time here in Kenya, but overall doing well.
Yeah. Do you mind actually? I mean, like you just told me, or do you mind just like quickly outlining like what's happening in Kenya right now? Because I think it might be interesting to hear, you know, what's kind of the business environment as well, or the environment that businesses are active in Eastern Africa sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting situation because, for the last few years, Kenya has really emerged, and Nairobi in particular has emerged as a tech hub in all of the African continent. It's an incredible place to do business. It's an incredible place to be an entrepreneur. But in the last 6 months, there have emerged a number of headwinds in the broader business environment. And some of these are macroeconomic. They're related to the shilling, the Kenyan currency depreciating relative to the dollar, or mainly the dollar getting stronger all over the world. The cost of fuel has risen. I mean, we have had massive inflation here, mainly driven by the cost of food and fuel. And that's created some real instability. And it's led to protests. So now here in the country, the opposition party that lost the recent election has been organizing protests multiple days every single week. So for multiple days every week, the city of Nairobi is almost on shutdown, like it's COVID all over again. And so yeah, it's really interesting. It's still an incredible place to be an entrepreneur, but definitely some things that we need to deal with as a country right now.
Yeah, no, that sounds like interesting times at least. And you just told me that leads to situations like being stuck in a parking lot because you can't pay for parking because the online payment provider that the whole nation uses is down. So definitely interesting times. Before we get to what you're doing in Kenya, and as you say, it's an amazing place to do business, I would like to ask you, how would you finish the sentence, Jit Bhattacharya, sorry if I butcher your name, is? How would you finish that sentence?
How would I finish that sentence? I think my friends would say that I should finish that sentence by saying Jit Bhattacharya is intense, because I am fairly intense. I'm very driven in terms of wanting to make an impact and do something significant, especially as it relates to climate change. And sometimes that can make me a fairly intense person to deal with. So that's probably the fairest term to describe me.
But I love that. I mean, I guess intense people usually have a lot of stuff going on in their heads, I mean. And I would like to know from you, what's the last time you had an aha moment?
Last time I had an aha moment. I mean, I guess we're going to talk more about our business, but I think the last time I really had an aha moment was actually even just in the last 2 weeks, seeing that. So, one of the pieces of technology that we've released here in the last couple of weeks is just this system for people in Nairobi to be able to pre-reserve a seat on an electric bus. And we didn't know how this technology was going to be adopted or anything like that. And as we saw the way that it was going to be used, the aha moment was, oh, people have been waiting for this. Like, we're just delivering something that everybody has essentially wanted for ages. They're tired of how the existing system works. And that was a real aha moment for us. We just thought we were playing around with a cool new idea. But no, what we actually hit on was something that could ultimately, just as much as electric drive, it could drive the future of how public transport and transportation here in East Africa works. So that was pretty exciting. This is the great thing about working on startups. You you have these moments, you're iterating so fast, you have aha moments almost every couple of weeks.
I love that. Kind of reminds me a bit of the quote, you know, that about people not wanting faster horses or so, but that you want, that they want completely new innovation. Sometimes it's not obvious what they want, but once it's there, it's obvious that everybody actually wants it. Before we go into what kind of business you're building, I'd also like to ask, you know, like, when did you question yourself the last time?
Oh, yeah, as an entrepreneur, I think you question yourself all the time. And the where I question myself in the last 2 weeks is it's been a rough 2 weeks for me because, as you can hear from my cough, I'm a little bit ill. My family has been ill. And on top of that, we are in the middle of fundraising and doing all the things you need to build a to build a venture-backed startup. And there's definitely moments where I'm questioning myself going, what have I gotten myself into? And I think that's standard, you know, and especially as an entrepreneur, you have this vision for where something goes. But I think the myth that the entrepreneur is always 100% confident in their vision and that they drive towards that no matter what. Yeah, that really is a myth. You question that. You question, are you right? Are you taking the right direction? Are you, you question that every single day that you're doing this. So I've definitely had moments in the last 2 weeks while lying in bed sick going, are we going to pull this off?
Questioning every single decision that you've made that led you up to this point. No, it's good to be vulnerable at times, I guess. Turning more to the business side of things, like, you already outlined that Kenya is a great place to do business, that it has developed into basically the tech hub on the continent. Where do you see Kenya's or maybe Africa's greatest potential in like the next decade when it comes to tech and entrepreneurship?
Well, I think it's phenomenal, right? Africa is home to six of the fastest growing economies in the world right now. Africa is going to be 25% of the world's population in the next 10 to 15 years. This is going to emerge as we have a rapidly growing middle class. In many ways, it's exactly like what China was in the 90s and what India was really over the last 15, 20 years. And so Africa is going to be the new growth market. We also have the largest young population in the world. And that population no longer believes that, you know, farming or traditional industry is going to be what makes them prosperous going forward. It's tech. That's what they want to work on. If you come into a city like Nairobi, you'll notice that about the young people. They're ambitious. They're driven. They want to be innovating. They want to change things. They want, and so I think tech and innovation is going to be central. Right now, a lot of the tech and innovation is still very Africa focused. And so I think one of the changes that we will see in the next 10 years that I'm excited to witness is going to be the emergence of technology coming from Africa that is now adopted in other markets. And you're just starting to see the beginnings of this. And I think you're going to see more, especially in the financial technology space. But I think you're going to see more and more of it in the years to come.
To what extent, because you spoke about the enthusiasm of the young population, to what extent is, like, you know, climate tech popular among the younger people? Because, you know, like, most of the like really successful African startups over the past years have mainly been in fintech, for example, right? So, like, is climate tech like a concern, as you were also speaking about technologies from other continents that might be adopted soon?
Climate tech is definitely a concern. Fintech gets a lot of the capital. Fintech gets a lot of the excitement. And it's because it's been the first sector of African venture that has shown the capability of returns, of venture level returns, especially for international investors. But climate tech is absolutely a focus and a desire more as a passion than anything else. And this is because climate change is not some future reality in Africa. Climate change is an everyday reality for us. I mean, here in Nairobi, in Kenya, we've gone through essentially 4 years of drought. We have missed multiple rainy seasons in a row and until the most recent one. And if you ever drove outside of Nairobi, just everything was dead. The farms were dead. The forests were dead. And this is reality for us in 2023. We're not in 2050. And so there is a strong motivation from young people here in Africa to start to do something about this, to no longer wait for the West to act, to do what we can here, both in the areas of mitigation, but also in terms of helping the continent adapt to a changing climate.
Yeah, when I was in Africa, it kind of seemed at times to me that, you know, being exposed to the effects of climate change a lot more directly is somewhat of an advantage when it comes to mobilizing the population and, you know, the intellectual resources that are there. Sometimes I feel in Europe or so, it's like, you know, people are just don't realize as much as people do in Africa, like how much of a thing climate change actually is.
It creates an urgency. It definitely creates an urgency. And you see that in the schools. You see that with how many young students at the technical universities are now studying topics related to sustainability, clean energy technologies, electric vehicles, for example, sustainable agriculture, et cetera. So yeah, you can definitely see the enthusiasm and the need, I think, driven by the fact that we see it every day.
Yeah. Jit, leading up to the business that you're building, I first have to ask you two questions about your past, and I ask you to please bear with me. But, you know, like people like you make it kind of hard to ask the right questions because you've seen so many different things and you have a rather rich pool of experience. So first of all, I would like to ask you something about how you work as a founder. And that is because in your past, you got an engineering degree from Stanford, MBA from Berkeley. So I kind of would like to ask you, you know, when should a founder like yourself think like an engineer and when like a business person? Do you have any like useful mental models that you apply for yourself?
Yes, I guess for me, and I'm one perspective here, but for me, when I think about founding a startup and building a pitch, I am thinking very much as an MBA. And it comes from the fact that, yeah, like you said, I have a fairly diverse background. So I've sat on the other side of a table. I've been an investor. I know what they look for. And so as a result, when I am crafting, is this going to be a compelling venture? I am very much putting on my MBA hat. I'm thinking about what does the return profile look like over how many years? What does the risk look like around all of this? Then on the other half of a startup, which is execution, and actually, I shouldn't even say half. It's the other 90%. In execution mode, I am an engineer because that is what we are trained to do as engineers. We're trained to plan. We're trained to think of things as systems, break down problems. Even if they're business problems sometimes, we're trained to break those problems down into piece by piece and then just block and tackle them and get them solved. And that's so much of what making a successful startup is about.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for that. And you just touched on your diverse background overall. You mentioned having been an investor, but like you've done a lot more than that. So you have been, I'm just going to like go through your background very briefly, but you've been the CEO of the Mission Motor Company in Silicon Valley, where you've been developing like battery systems and other useful stuff for EVs and hybrids. Then you joined Apple as an engineering manager. And from there, you made the jump to Africa, working as the CTO of Phoenix International, which is actually like one of the most successful solar companies on the African continent. I'd like to know a bit like how has each of these stations shaped how you work as a founder today?
Oh, yeah. Well, every single one had an impact. Mission Motors is what gave me my introduction to the energy sector and to climate technology. And to electric vehicle technology in general. So that was my introduction to the sector. Then at Apple is really where I wish I had an experience like Apple earlier in my career. It's one of the pieces of advice I give young engineers and even entrepreneurs is to say, look, there's value sometime, especially in these large tech companies that have just figured out processes and ways of doing things that is highly educational. It's like a master's after your master's. And I feel like so much of my approach now, especially to execution, to engineering, to operations, is built around my experience from Apple. At Phoenix, Phoenix is, as you said, it's a solar company, but it was a solar financing company, right? According to this pay-as-you-go model, which has really unlocked small-scale solar systems for rural homes in Africa. And so financing was a really key piece of that. And that was really my first experience in this area of pay-as-you-go financing for African ventures, which I carried forward, obviously, into my investment role as well, looking for other companies that were leveraging that model in an effective way in order to scale how new energy technologies were being deployed. And then fundamentally, what we're doing at Basigo is essentially a combination of what I did at all places, where it's the EV technology from Mission Motors, the execution from Apple, and then the pay-as-you-go finance from Phoenix all coming together. So every piece of experience you've got in your career ultimately helps carry you forward into your next role.
Awesome. You're also doing my work for me. You perfectly transitioned onto the topic of what you're building today, meaning Basigo. Could you briefly outline your vision for the company and what you're doing today?
Yeah, so Basigo, our mission is to create the future of clean electric public transport here in Africa. And by public transport, buses are still the heart of the mobility ecosystem here in sub-Saharan Africa. They're the most affordable and the most accessible means of transport for especially our low-income population. So this is how most people get around is by bus. And so one of the problem is these buses are also a huge, they cause a lot of damage to the local environment because of the air pollution coming out of these buses. Most of them have no diesel emissions filter. So if you ever come to an African city, you'll drive behind a bus and you will see that you are getting pure unfiltered diesel emissions, black soot coming out of the tailpipe. And we actually saw this in the very beginning of the COVID pandemic. We had 3 days where the Kenyan government stopped all the buses from operating, and almost overnight, the air in Nairobi completely cleared, and we could see Mount Kenya 300 kilometers away. And for many Kenyans, that was the first time they'd seen Mount Kenya that clear on the horizon. They forgot that it was there. They forgot how close it was. And so it was a really remarkable experience and showed what would happen if we could clean up this public transport sector here. On top of that, we have this really remarkable opportunity here in Kenya, where 90% of our electricity already comes from renewable energy. We're blessed with large reserves of geothermal and hydropower. As a result, what you're looking at is if you electrify a bus here, the bus is heavily utilized, and when it gets recharged, it's getting recharged from 90% renewable power. Compare that to the rest of the world, especially places where electric buses are dominant, places like China, places like India. What you're seeing is that those buses are getting powered by coal. And so the net environmental impact is actually almost insignificant. Whereas here in Kenya, we could get 50 tons of CO2 mitigation from a single bus every single year if we switch from diesel to electric. So that was the motivation behind what we were building. And we said, well, can we build a model, and especially a model that allows us to address the most difficult barrier to adoption of new energy technologies, which is the high upfront cost. You know, here in Africa, as a frontier market, cost of capital is very high and cash sensitivity is very high. A lot of people just don't have the cash for large down payments and capital investments. And so what we realized is, yes, we have a situation where an electric vehicle technology, especially in the bus sector, will actually have an overall lower cost compared to a diesel bus over its life. But we have to develop a financing model that will allow us to bring down that upfront cost. And so from there emerged Busigo. And so Busigo, we are fundamentally a financing and infrastructure company. We're providing a novel financing model called pay-as-you-drive, which makes electric buses directly competitive on a cash flow basis compared to diesel buses. And we provide charging infrastructure, which the operators have to use. But there's one other thing with starting a company in Africa, and that is oftentimes in the energy space, when you're building a venture like this, you actually have to build the entire value chain from scratch. You have to start vertically integrated. And so that's why you see actually what Busigo does is we're also involved in specifying buses, working with OEMs to create the right vehicle spec and to tailor design buses for the African market. We are on our paths to locally assembling buses because that's what we need to do in order to compete. We had to build a service and maintenance network because right now there's no service and maintenance network to speak of to be able to support these electric buses. So what you find so often in African venture is you have to build an entire value chain. And so Busigo looks like we're doing quite a lot. But if you ever ask what our core is, we will say we are a financing and an infrastructure company to help accelerate the deployment of electric buses on the continent.
Awesome. Thank you so much for diving into this. I actually got two questions for you. And the first one is, do you see any limits to this pay as you go or like, you know, forward front financing model? Because, you know, it is also being quite successful in Germany, in Europe right now in general, mainly being applied in the solar space as well. So I just wonder, you know, like it's one thing to finance a solar panel, but it's another thing to finance a bus. But do you think there are any limits to, you know, the size of the object being financed?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Look, I think what we've seen, the solar industry is a really great precedent. What we have seen is that the power purchase agreement model, which is essentially effectively the same thing, right? Where people no longer buy or people don't buy the solar panel, but instead buy the power that those solar panels generate. Or another model is more a leasing model, right? Where basically building owners and homeowners are leasing the panels that are on the roof. I think we've seen how that's had such an impact on the ability, especially of commercial and industrial solar, to scale across the world, not just in Africa, but really across the world. But what do we all, well, so the downside of that is, of course, any financing model requires quite a significant amount of capital in order to be able to scale. But what's exciting about what we are doing in this financing model is this is all about cash flow. And here, by deploying this pay-as-you-drive financing model, what we're able to do is we're able to actually double bus owners' monthly cash flow every single month. Okay. Simply through lower operating costs, while still offering a commercial rate of return to both debt and equity investors. And that's pretty exciting. So these are bus operators right now here in Kenya. Over the last 18 months, the cost of fuel has risen 60%. So they're really suffering from the uncertainty of what is fuel going to cost next month. And so they're looking for an alternative. And luckily, electricity prices are much more stable. And here we're coming in with a financing model that is all inclusive. So it already includes all the costs of charging and everything. And we're basically able to offer them a dramatic operating cost savings for a purchase of the bus that is equivalent or cheaper than the existing diesel bus. So it's just a much higher return on investment. And this is what gets me excited about certain sustainability venture models is when we can find a model that effectively can scale, provide a clear economic value proposition here in Africa. Look, I think you asked earlier about people's interest in sustainability. And people are interested in sustainability, but we're a frontier market. So nobody is able to pay what we call the green premium in Western markets, right? Where you can buy a Tesla, even though Tesla doesn't necessarily make economic sense. But yeah, if you're wealthy enough, you can go and buy a Tesla. But here in Africa, no, if it doesn't make economic sense, they'll say, well, we would love it. We wish we could have that, but it has to make us more money. It has to improve incomes. We are not cash rich. And so when we can find a model that does exactly that, which achieves significant CO2 mitigation and also can work within the current terms of commercial capital and risk profiles, that's really exciting because it has opportunity in the early years to scale. Now, long-term, you asked about limitations. I think we're starting to see in the solar industry some of the limitations of these financing models, which is ultimately if an owner is able to just purchase the asset directly, like a solar panel or like an electric bus, and then they get access to charging and they're paying for electricity, of course, that's a better deal for them. But here, right now, where we stand in the electric bus industry, and a current electric bus is about 2 to 3 times the cost of a diesel bus if you were to just buy it outright. And that is impossible for any diesel bus owner here in Kenya to be able to finance. And so for the time being, for the next decade or so, we think our financing model is going to be the thing that really unlocks this market and the climate impact.
And just to really understand this, so this lower, dramatically lower cost is basically driven by the energy profile, if that's a good term for it, that Kenya has, right? So you're basically able to cancel out all the fuel costs, all the fossil fuel-based costs that diesel bus owners previously incurred via offering them the electricity, renewable electricity-powered buses.
Yeah, that's right. So right now in Kenya, a diesel bus operator is paying over $2,300 every single month for diesel fuel. By comparison, to get the same number of kilometers in that month using electricity from the grid costs less than $500. And so that's why over the life of the vehicle, the electric bus is actually much more economical, even when you include that higher upfront cost. But it takes time to work that back because the upfront cost is still significantly higher for EVs compared to combustion engine.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. And you mentioned that you have to vertically integrate as a company in Africa working on the frontier. So it's not just enough to come up with a financing model. And so you mentioned that you are actually manufacturing and assembling buses now. So I did a bit of research and tell me if I'm right at least, but your first two electric buses were manufactured in China and then you have a current batch being assembled in Kenya. So I would like to ask you actually, like, how do you navigate this web of suppliers and manufacturers? Or if you do that for the first time as a founder, do you have any advice?
Yeah, so the situation is actually the first two buses we brought in were actually fully built. The next two buses we brought in, or the next 15 buses we brought in, were actually mostly fully built. We did the interiors here in Africa. and and specifically here in Kenya. And the reason that we have to locally assemble is all related to taxes. And you'll hear this in the automotive industry all over the world. Import taxes are a significant barrier. Now, I think Elon Musk was asked a couple of months ago, when are Teslas coming to Africa? And his response was exactly the right one. It's, well, the problem is the import taxes. And if we're importing a fully built Tesla, you're going to almost double the cost of that vehicle here in Kenya with the import taxes. Whereas if you locally assembled that Tesla, you pay no import duty, you pay no excise tax. And so with passenger car manufacturing, that's quite difficult. But actually with commercial vehicles, things like buses and trucks, that's not as complicated. We are able to, given the lower volumes, we're able to ultimately locally assemble. And in Kenya, it's remarkable because we actually have established local assembly partners. So what we do is we bring in modern electric bus technology, but it comes essentially as parts. But it all comes from it comes from a given electric bus OEM. So it's not coming from many different suppliers or anything like that. It's actually still coming from a single OEM. It's their bus because that's the bus model that's been tested. It's been certified. And so you don't want to go around changing. We're not inventing our own bus. We're just bringing in a bus as parts. And then we locally assemble it at one of these local assembly partners. And so our partner is a company called AVA. They're located in Mombasa. And they're already manufacturing buses and trucks for brands like Toyota and Mitsubishi, Scania out of Europe. And so this is the model that we're able to pursue, but it's not quite as complicated as you might imagine. Our big focus is, okay, how can we start to turn some of the parts that we're using in this local assembly, how can we change some of those parts to being locally produced? And that's something that we want to be able to do over time. And long term, we even aspire to how could we start to manufacture some of the powertrain components here in Africa? I think everybody, that's the big goal that everybody has here. How can we manufacture battery packs, motors, things like that?
Yeah, basically moving Africa or Kenya in this case from being mainly consumer market to a producer market. So where like all manufacturing is basically done at home so that you can actually like, you know, export stuff and be less independent on, well, international markets, I guess.
That's right. And also just create jobs, right? So many of the raw materials going into lithium ion batteries are actually originating in Africa. So there's absolutely the possibility. We just don't have quite that technology manufacturing sector. It doesn't quite exist yet. But I think in the next 10 years, hopefully that will start to change as well.
Yeah. No, awesome. Talking about the lithium batteries, you know, like in Europe, one of the biggest concerns is always, you know, like the limited supply of lithium in the world when it comes to EVs overall and their scalability. Like, what's your take on this topic?
Yeah, look, I think as the number of electric vehicles grow, we are going to need to make sure that we're solving the supply chain problems for things like lithium ion batteries, for rare earth magnets, if that's what's needed for electric motors. You can't build an EV industry and have it completely take over for over 50% of all vehicle production for passenger cars, commercial vehicles, if we don't also solve those supply chain problems. I think what I'm really inspired by is what's happening right now in recycling technology for batteries, and especially from companies like Redwood Materials, founded by one of the former co-founders of Tesla, where what they're doing is now they're looking at ways that we can take spent lithium ion batteries and then essentially recycle them to be able to be used in new lithium ion batteries because the chemicals are all there. Ultimately, long term, we have to build a circular supply chain for a lot of these key components or the key materials, especially those going into lithium ion batteries. And that means recycling used batteries back into new batteries somehow.
Yeah, no, got it. I'd like to talk a bit about like how you deploy the capital that you have raised, because you've like a check raised, I think up to date, like about $11 million. First of all, congrats to that for that. I think in the African realm, that's a pretty big amount of cash that not a lot of companies are able to raise. And I'd just like to ask, you know, how do you deploy this capital currently? And like, which of the activities that you're working on do you have to be the most careful with when executing them?
Right now, I think our focus is really demonstrating that the buses and the financing model can work. And that's where we've really focused on deploying our capital. I think the way we've done it, so far, all of our operation is here in Nairobi. We now have 19 buses in operation. So our capital basically went to how do we get these 19 buses here? How do we get them deployed and finance? We are providing the financing directly to our clients right now. And we've also had to invest in the charging infrastructure to be able to support it. And basically what we're looking to do is build the entire model and then demonstrate that our long-term model is financially feasible according to the assumptions that we have put in place. So any EV financing model like this has a lot of commercial assumptions, a lot of technical assumptions baked in. And so the deployment of our seed capital was all around that. And what I'm really excited about is that over the 2 years, we have demonstrated exactly that. So now what we're doing is we're really in our commercialization phase, where we're raising larger amounts of capital to deliver. We have over 100 reservations from bus operators here in Nairobi who are waiting for buses. So now we're raising significantly more capital, grow the team, be able to grow the charging network and the number of buses that we're able to finance. And then one of the big transitions is now we start to take on debt to be able to finance the leasing of these batteries and these buses to clients. And so yeah, that's the way we think about it, is for every single phase of growth, what is it that we need to demonstrate in order to raise our next round, or in order to raise the capital required for that next round of growth? And this round of growth is really what's aimed at taking us, you know, much closer to profitability, definitely profitable unit economics, and hopefully closer to profitability. And then from there, it's really growth equity.
I would be really interested to hear, because another founder told me that, you know, African banks are very risk averse and have a hard time, you know, lending to startups overall. Like, what has been your experience with that, when you're saying now that you're taking on debt now?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. And that's why here in Africa, we don't just look to the African banks. We also look to development finance institutions, especially those from Europe, as a common source of debt, because they are more risk tolerant. They have more of an impact lens. But what's very exciting right now is that climate change is so front and center for everyone that even the African banks are eager to get involved in supporting and growing the space. Many of them have green mandates that they're looking to fill. And so what we're finding is an openness, even with African banks, to let's change the risk profile we're willing to take on in order to try and help this sector grow.
Yeah, awesome. I'm curious right now, actually. Like, I thought about your time in Silicon Valley and, like, you know, like the way you're talking, the way you're pitching and so on, you know, you can definitely tell that you've spent some time there. I wonder, but, like, you know, like, what lessons from Silicon Valley transfer well to Africa and which don't when building a company there?
What lessons transfer well? I don't even know if it's lessons from Silicon Valley so much, as it is lessons in entrepreneurship that are just universal, honestly. Silicon Valley is its own ecosystem. It's very fast in terms of capital availability. That's what makes it unique as an entrepreneur, that you can be having a conversation with an investor and a few days later you can be capitalized. That does not translate well in Africa. Raising capital is definitely much slower. It's much harder. And so that's just something that African entrepreneurs, I think we're all faced with. And I will, you know, I think it's important to point out, I work here in Africa. I've started a startup here in Africa, and yet it is much easier for me to raise money than an actual African founder. For example, I'm able to fly to the U.S. Because I have a U.S. passport with no problem. Average African founders have to apply for visas to be able to fly and meet with venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley or in Europe or something like this. And there's serious barriers for capital raising for African founders. What translates well from Silicon Valley, number one, I think, like I said before, that experience that I gained from some of the large tech companies who've already been through this, have figured out processes. It really gives you a framework from which to understand what does high-level execution work look like. And that's really phenomenal. I think the other thing that I find that's now more universal is just, you know, what is it? It's basically iterate fast. You know, don't waste a lot of time trying to come up with the perfect solution. Don't let the technology be your driving factor. Make the customer your driving factor, right? Like, focus on what their need is. What's the problem that you're solving? And are you solving it in really a way that's meaningful for them? You know, those are lessons I learned in Silicon Valley, but I could have learned from a startup, frankly, anywhere. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Returning to what you're doing today and how you're manufacturing EV buses from the ground up, I would actually be interested. You know, I think there's another startup, I think from Sweden even, that is retrofitting diesel and gasoline vehicles, turning them electric. Like, how do you think about the case of retrofitting and how it compares to from, you know, ground up manufacturing?
I think there's really three classes of business model around this, especially in frontier markets. So one is what we're doing, which is the local assembly of brand new vehicles. And that's the path that we're taking. So these are modern EVs coming from major OEMs. They're just coming as parts and we're locally assembling them. The second is what we call retrofitting, which is taking a used vehicle that used to be a combustion engine vehicle and converting it into an electric vehicle. That model is quite challenging. And it's challenging because how do you certify that vehicle? How do we, in automotive, we have all of these standards and certifications we need to do in order to ensure safety, and especially in public transport. Safety has to be number one. But here you have a used chassis who it's impossible to fully characterize the quality of that chassis based on its former life. It wasn't designed for use as an electric vehicle. And now you've converted it, you've changed the weighting, you've changed the center of gravity, all of this. And you want to put it back out on the road. And frankly, every single vehicle you retrofit like that is different. And so how do you certify that? I think is this open question. Some countries have done a good job creating standards and methodologies for that. But here in Africa, I think that's going to be really difficult, especially given how beat up our vehicles are after even just a few years on the road. Then you have a third category here, which is halfway in between both of those. It's called electrofitting. And electrofitting is where you take a chassis for especially a commercial vehicle that maybe was designed for a combustion engine, but it's a brand new chassis, and instead you install an electric powertrain. And I think you're seeing companies like there's Shift EV in Egypt, for example, is a remarkable company that's doing this. And I think that model can absolutely work, especially if it has the blessing and partnership of the chassis manufacturer. And so yeah, of those three models, I would say I have some concerns about retrofitting, but electrofitting of new chassis, and then obviously our model where we're bringing in brand new vehicles and then locally assembling, I think can absolutely work.
Awesome. Yeah. No, thank you so much for, giving a bit more diverse view of this issue that sometimes can be, sometimes you're struggling as a person looking at AVs, wouldn't it just make sense to look at all the cars on the road and like just retrofit them rather than manufacturing from the ground up. But I think this makes a lot of sense. I'd like to know regarding Basi Go, I'd like to ask you to make a few predictions, on your way to scaling, putting 1,000 buses on the road in the next 5 years or so, cleaning up Kenyan air and emissions, what will be, first of all, the key steps for Basi Go to succeed? But I would actually be more interested in, your vision for Basi Go in terms of what kind of different products and business lines do you envision developing? You know what I mean? What's kind of the Basi Go ecosystem that you want to build?
Yeah, so I think going back to who we are, we're really a financing and infrastructure company more than anything else. And I think what makes me so excited about this pay-as-you-drive financing model that we've come up with is if we can make this work for buses, and it should work, if it can work in any commercial vehicle sector first, it's going to work for buses because of their mileage, because they're working in urban environments. This is just something we know in the EV industry. But if we can make this work for buses, we can make this work for any high mileage urban commercial vehicle. So think about courier delivery trucks, for example, think about garbage trucks, et cetera. And this can become the financing and infrastructure model that allows us to scale commercial EV adoption, help these commercial vehicle operators get freedom from these rising diesel costs. We can start to scale this across so many different sectors. We're already scaling across geographies. So if you look at the news in the last 24 hours, we just announced we're expanding to Rwanda. And in many ways, this is at the request of the ecosystem in Rwanda, which is saying what we need is somebody who's solving these problems of charging, finance, and actually service and maintenance as well. And so we're finding we're in a really good place right now in order to take fundamentally the innovation is around that pay-as-you-drive financing model. And if we can make it work here, the sky's the limit in terms of where we can take it.
Awesome. And, in terms of sky being the only limit, one thing in Africa is, technical talent, actually. So I was just thinking of that. And some founders have been telling me, it's really hard to find talent that is not necessarily, it's not an issue to find motivated, driven talent, but sometimes find the talent that can, actually, provide the skills that you're looking for. How do you think about A, this issue, and B, how do you, as someone with an engineering background, vet the talent that you're hiring?
Yeah. Honestly, I think we haven't found the talent to be as much of an issue as it is. I think while maybe you don't have exactly the level of technical talent on certain, you know, I'll give it a great example. There's no charging in electric vehicle industry here in Africa, really of any scale. And so you don't have a lot of engineers who've worked on something like charging infrastructure. Very few African engineers have worked on charging infrastructure because very little charging infrastructure has been deployed. So how do you go through and you solve that problem? And oftentimes you do need to augment sometimes with international talent, and not even talent, experience. It's really more a question of experience. But that international experience also lacks something very important: knowledge of how to do business and work on the ground here in Africa. And that is something that Africans know better than anybody else. And so it's not even that there's a lack of talent, it's that the talent looks different from what we're accustomed to in Western markets. And so in that respect, I think we have been really blessed that working on something like this, the level of passion and enthusiasm around sustainability, especially from young people coming out of universities right now, or even early in their careers, is just phenomenal. The dedication that they're putting towards this. And so you asked this question of how do we vet? I think what we really look for almost first before everything else is alignment to our mission. So we obviously we're looking for the other qualifications of, do you have the skills for the job that we're looking to do? Even if you don't have the direct experience, do you have the acumen that you can learn? You know, sometimes we have to have some openness to that. So we're really looking for willingness to learn. But more than anything else, we look for alignment to our mission, because then we know that they're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that the mission succeeds.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Did I leave any blind spot with my questions regarding BarsiGo? Is there something that you would get out about the company? Because I'd otherwise transition on to my outro questions, which are not necessarily related to BarsiGo.
Well, yeah, I think one thing I commonly get asked, you touched on it a little bit with the question around capital and limits of the model and things like that. But one of the common questions is, well, what are the key challenges that we face? And the key challenges we face really are twofold. One of them you've already touched on, and that's capital. You know, any kind of financing model like this, whether it's in solar, whether it's in wind, whether it's in electric vehicles, it requires a lot of capital. And that's a challenge in our model. A challenge in our model is you go to a venture capitalist, 9 out of 10 venture capitalists you speak to will go, well, we don't really like capital intensive businesses. Which I totally get. I used to be a venture capital investor. But at the same time, if we truly want to address climate change, there is a point where we have to overcome that fear and overcome that limit and actually buy hardware and get it on the ground, taking the place of the hardware that's using fossil fuels. So that's really important. So capital intensity is one of our barriers. The other is charging. Charging is, but not in the way that most people think. Everybody thinks, oh, how are you going to deploy EV charging in Africa? Isn't electricity incredibly unreliable? Actually, in Kenya here, our grid it's fairly reliable, especially at night. Our grid is very reliable, and we have a surplus of electricity, renewable energy at night, ready to charge these vehicles. But actually going through and finding the places to deploy this charging, going through the process of getting power to those sites, preparing the sites to be able to handle the charging infrastructure, the vehicles coming in, all of this. It's an incredibly challenging problem. And it's also tied to real estate and land, which is always a tricky issue here in Africa. And so that actually becomes one of the barriers to scale as well, is how quickly can we scale charging? So those are really the two things that we have to overcome if we're going to get to 1,000 buses in the next 3 years.
Awesome. Jit, thank you so much. I'm going to finish our time together. I'd like to ask you for some personal advice, actually. And first off, you know, put yourself in my shoes. You're about to start your career this year. And what arguments do you see for joining a startup, a climate tech startup today? And how would you evaluate opportunities that come at you?
Look, I think it's working in climate tech is an absolute, for anybody who has passion for the sector, like, the time is absolutely right now. I was a climate tech entrepreneur doing what we called Clean Tech 1.0. Clean Tech 1.0 was the period of time from, I would call 2007 to about 2014, right around the financial crisis. And, you know, there, I think, honestly, the feeling in the industry was a little bit different. I think there were a lot of venture capitalists seeking, you know, dot-com era returns and things like that. This time around, it feels very different in that it's really about emissions impact. It's about actually solving the problem. And so in that respect, the time is absolutely now. Now, whether it's a startup or whether it's a more established company, honestly, my advice is find the role where you think you can learn the most and find a mentor or a boss who you feel you can learn from.